Here we go. You ready?
Me.
Thank you. G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
G'day to you too.
I'm intrigued, my friend, because a few days ago, maybe a week ago, you wrote something on Hebrew in Israel at gmail.com. That's your email address if people want some quality Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the land, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. But on your Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel, and people can find it, you wrote the following, my friend, and I don't know what this is about. You wrote, I think I will be making a confession next time I will be recording with Jono. I think it's time that I tell the truth about some things. Some of you might guess what I will say, but let's leave it to the next recording. And now here we are, doing the next recording, and I'm on the edge of my seat, so I want you to get into the confession box. Get in there. Get in. I'll sit on the other side.
Clop.
Okay. Tell
I have
me.
To go, I, have to go down, I have to go down one knee or something, no?
I don't know. I've never actually been in a confession box.
I don't know either. I mean, I don't know. I've seen some stuff in movies. I don't know if it's that's how it works.
Maybe they kneel.
I don't know. I mean, there is the issue of going down on your knees and, you know, some kind of like, you know, submission or something. I don't really know. You know,
I actually went into, we have in Sydney, I think it's St. Mary's is the big grand cathedral, and I really dig the architecture. And I went in there once, I remember, and I saw the confession boxes, and I thought, hey, that could be fun. And I went in there, but there was no one on the other side. I was just talking to myself.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, that was no fun.
Not very good service, huh?
No. Well, whatever was going on, it must have been lunchtime because no one was there. Didn't do it again.
Isn't it supposed to be like a priest on call for a confession?
Well, that was my. I mean, every time you know you see someone in the movies, you see someone running.
There's
always a priest stuck in the confession box, ready to get the latest goss.
No, if it's gossip, I mean, no. There's one thing I do know that's very interesting is that they actually, you know, they're not supposed to say anything, and. That's actually something.
Maybe there was someone there.
Maybe I don't know. That's actually something very admirable. That I do have to admit that as far as I know, what goes in the confession box doesn't come out ever from the mouth of a priest.
Let me assure you that whatever you say right now, I won't tell anyone. So get in the confession box
You're not going to be. You might not be telling anyone, but I think this recording everyone's going to be able to hear. So I don't know what I gained from this.
What's the news?
Well, how exactly would I put this? this is kind of difficult for me to do because it kind of it's something I've been very protective of for quite a while.
This is not something I have to edit out. I mean,
no, you have to wait. This is not something you have to edit out. I just have never said this in public. There's no Easter Bunny.
You can't tell everyone that. Next, they'll be wondering about other things like the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus. What are you telling everybody these things for? And how would you know? Anyway, you're Jewish. You don't know these things. You don't know the intricate details of. You don't even know if you kneel in the confession box. How do you know there's no Easter Bunny?
Because we have inside information. Okay, now a bit more seriously. We were just doing the kind of like the Purim type of thing, Purim spiel thing that we're just being funny about. It's a bit more serious. How would I put this? I've alluded to this idea quite a few times. In recordings that we've done, and I have kind of said this, but not exactly. So here's the confession. Several years ago, I had a very, very long discussion with a very good friend of mine, and he said to me something very, very important. He said to me that it's more important to face the truth than to lie about things. Now, I don't think he's right about lying. I mean, I don't think there's an issue of lying here. But what this discussion basically did, it opened up a very, very old discussion I've had for years already with my fellow brothers and sisters in the Jewish world. Mm-hmm. And these also have been discussions with people who are not Jewish as well. And basically, the conclusion I came to was that there actually is no oral law. In other words, I actually do not believe in the oral law. And I have not believed in the oral law for quite a few years. So I had a friend, a childhood friend, who was my neighbor for throughout my entire childhood, who happened to be secular. And he went to a secular school. And when we were children, he introduced me to the debate, because he came from a secular school. They studied the Bible a bit differently than we did. And he basically introduced me to the discussion about not to cook or boil a kid in its mother's milk. And he showed me the sources from Umberto Casuto, also known as one of the heretic in the Orthodox world, and he actually, his commentary is actually amazing. You can actually get his commentary on Genesis and Exodus. You can actually get off of Magnus Publications. It's very, very good reading. Mm-hmm. And
what's his name again? Give us his name again.
Umberto Casuto.
Thank you.
I actually posted something about him on Facebook, so. You can actually find his name and read about him. He was Italian. He was a very interesting man. And he introduced me to discussion about what does it actually mean. And that was like, I don't know, when I was I can't even remember how old I was back then. It was like I was 11 or 12 back then. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I went, and I remember I started talking to my dad about this. And my dad is a very, very interesting man. He doesn't lie. He doesn't hide information. He's actually very, very blunt about things. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, there is such a discussion, and there are things that have to be understood about how the ancient world worked. And that was basically what he said to me. I can't remember the exact words. You can't catch me on the exact words.
So when you told him, he didn't write it off, right?
No. When I was 5 years old, I turned around to my dad and said, who is God? And my dad said, you know, there's stories about children asking that and the father slapping the child in the face saying, no, never ask questions like that. My dad turned around basically said, listen, I can't tell you who God is. I can just tell you that we have a heritage that he appeared on Mount Sinai to our people and he created everything you see. Mm-hmm. And my dad looked at my mother and went, huh, I have to watch out for this one. And basically, I started going around asking anyone I could about this verse. And everyone kept on telling me, it's an issue of not eating meat and milk. And you know, so I said, okay, fine. But how come it says, don't lo tevashel, don't cook, don't boil? Actually, it's cook. Tevashel is bishul. It's a general word that means to cook, boil, sear, or whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And I at one point, I actually went to the rabbi's son and I asked him, and he kept on explaining that we have a tradition. And I said, yes, but again, based on context, on what the words are actually saying, what does this mean? And he says, don't eat meat and milk. And I said, yes, but it's not saying don't eat a cheeseburger, don't eat, you know, whatever, chicken with cheese sauce or something or whatever. It says, don't take a kid, gidi, and cook it behalev imon, his mother's milk. And I kept on stressing this. And he ran up to his father and said, listen, Yoel is saying words of kfira, words of heresy. And the rabbi said, okay, let him ask. Just don't worry about it. Let him ask the questions and he'll figure it out by himself. And the rabbi was a very, very interesting man. He was a very friendly man. I don't know if he's still alive. My guess is he is, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. And my dad, he looks at my dad. My dad says, you know, he's one of the thinkers in our family. You have to be very careful with him. Don't try to give him an answer that doesn't work with the information he has. And this went on for a while. And I started looking into, when I was a kid in fourth grade, I remembered reading about Karaites because we had our textbook about Judaism had an entire chapter about Karaites. Now, that textbook, by the way, has been completely scratched off from curriculum, and you never really learn what we learned about Karaites when we were children. There was more reasonable information back then than what there is today. But
is there a reason for that? What do you think?
I don't mind guessing that maybe some religious people meddled in the program and said, okay, we have to scratch it. Children must not be exposed to this. But when we were children, we were told about the Aviv. They actually brought barley in and showed us everything. They actually took us. We had even had field trips. It was really weird. Back in the 80s, this was very strange. Back in the 80s, they were very open about a lot of things. They talked about the new moon, about calendar calculation, about Aviv. And You know, so I grew up in a time where this, people spoke about this. There were programs about Karaites on television. There was a Karaite elder who actually went on television a couple of times. Actually, I found the video. I saw this video back when it actually originally aired. And I remember hearing the elder make a mistake and turn around to my dad and says, but that's not what the verse says. And he says, yes, exactly, that's not what the verse says. And I actually found the video and I had like a flashback, which was really weird. And then, you know, I started enrolling in you know, high school and everything. And I was like told, like, you know, my dad said, you know, there's certain questions don't ask in certain places because you have to be very, very, very careful with what you say to people. So I tucked this thing very into my deepest pocket that there is, and I never opened up my mouth, but I continued researching. So I learned about the Samaritans, I learned about the Karaites, and when I was about 15, 16, I actually met one of the members of the Karaite family who used to live in the Old City, and I happened to remember him, and several years later I actually met him again and spoke with him. But I was basically told, you know, don't ask these questions by rabbis in my school and everything. And I actually was the kid who walked around with a Bible in his hand and interpreted things to himself. But I was very rabbinic as well. I mean, I always tried to explain things as rabbinic as possible. But for example, I open up the verse that says, you know, you have to put a blue thread in your tzitzit. And that's exactly what I did. I found a source for tchelet. It was one type and there's another type. And I started wearing it when I was around the age of, I think it was like 15. I was the first kid in my high school to wear a tchelet. And I was the
only, pioneer.
I was the only one in the town I grew up in my synagogue. I was the only one. So I had like what you can say connections to different places. But it wasn't like a decision that I made. I just said, okay, I'm interested in this information. I started looking into it. And my biggest hobby during Shabbat when I didn't have to go to school, I remember my school schedule was I woke up at 5:30 in the morning, left home by 6:15, and was at school until 8 o'clock in the evening. So I had no time for friends, anything. So one of my things I really enjoyed doing during Shabbat was actually sitting with my Bible and studying. And I used to sit 3-4 hours straight as a kid reading Bible from entire books from beginning to end. And Samuel, by the way, the book of Samuel was my favorite book back then.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, and I grew up with Torah, and this is why when it comes to Torah, I actually am very good at navigating through Torah because this was something we grew up with children. It was intense. We had every day we had Torah classes, every single day. And I was actually considered to be the big expert on temple service in school because I was fascinated with it. I had booklets, I had books, I knew everything about a piece of clothing and stuff that usually most of the children in my class had no idea what it was. And I was always fascinated with the Temple Institute, though I have a lot of remarks to make today about things that they did. But back then, it was like that was my shrine. That was like every time I went to Jerusalem, that's the place I wanted to go visit. And when I went to yeshiva, which was basically around the age of 17 and a half, it's usually you go there when you're 18. I'm actually considered to be young in my class. And I actually went to the Karaite family because the yeshiva I went to happens to be Yeshivat HaKotel. I actually went here. I exposed some information about myself. I actually went to Yeshivat HaKotel for a while. And I went in there and I knocked on the door and I said, Shalom, my name is Yoel. I happened to be that the guy I met back then several years earlier was at the door. And I said, you know, we spoke a couple of years ago, and I'm interested to know some information about the Karaite movement. He said, okay, fine. And I went in and sat with him for hours, speaking back and forth, explaining things. And they were very, very friendly people. They remember me until this very day. I bump into them every once in a while, and they're very friendly towards me. And we started talking, and then someone saw me talk with them. So he ran up to me, and this guy pulled me aside and said, no, listen, you have to be very careful. They brainwash people. And I don't know. And he started, you know, basically telling me off. And he went to the head of the yeshiva and told him about this. And they were all concerned because one of the things they were worried about was the fact that when I applied to the yeshiva, they wrote down, what do I want to do as an adult? And I wrote down biblical studies and archaeology. And that switched a big red light in their heads. And they walked up to me and said, why did you write this? And I said, well, one of my points is I want to understand the word of God as it is. And I want to understand the history of our nation the best I can to prove that the Bible is true.
Yeah.
And the guy blinked. And he had nothing to say. He just walked away with a very concerned look on his face. So I was like told off, don't talk with him, everything. So I kept away from the Karaite family. And that's why I tucked this thing in very deep. But I was looking for truth. I was looking for what is the truth about the Torah? What is the truth about the Word of God? You know, it burned in me for years. And I traveled all over the country. I've been in every part of Israel, in areas that most people don't get a chance to even go into. I've been in Nablus, which is somewhere most Israelis can go and get into. I've been at the Samaritans. I've been in Judea and Samaria, the Galilee, south. I've been basically everywhere in Israel. And I basically was seeking for truth. And I discovered, I was also exposed as a teenager to Maimonides and the Yemenites and everything. That was very authentic. It's very Second Temple period type of Judaism. So I was fascinated with them. And I started following, even earlier on, I started following everything that the Maimonides writes. And I did that for the better part of 10 years. You know, I was studying and everything and continuing. And I used to walk around with phylacteries all day, with tefillin all day and everything. I was very serious about my Judaism. And that was the time when I actually met up Rico Cortez, and he became a very good friend of mine as well. And I was working in this place which dealt with the Third Temple. People always confuse it with the Temple Institute. We were not the Temple Institute, it was something else. But I had to be very careful what I say, because I was living in an ultra-Orthodox community. And I was one of the types that actually went out to work. So I was always considered like the layman. But the people who actually knew me knew that if they need to know stuff, they actually knock on my door and come into my house and sit and talk with me. Because I had information, I was able to think outside of certain boxes the community wasn't
able
to.
Sure, yeah.
And I remember the first incidents when people realized I actually know the Tanakh better than they do. They could recite any verse that you imagine. They knew the Tanakh backwards and forwards by reciting. We were sitting there one night, and I realized at one point that a lot of the people I know, including Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox, Orthodox, and even secular, don't really know the Tanakh well. They don't really know what they're reading. So I said, there was one time we're sitting down and we're talking about the book of Echa, Lamentations, and the guy was asking, okay, what does this word mean? And I broke it down for him. He looked at me and he said, how do you know this? I said, because I happened to study biblical Hebrew, and I actually did 4 years of Hebrew in high school, and I did final exams, and I've been studying biblical Hebrew for years already. Not on the level I am in now. That took then deciding to really venture into the study. But I knew a lot of the basics of Hebrew on a level that most teenagers and most adults actually don't know. And I broke it down. I said, "How do you know this?" He says, "Well, very simple. You just learn certain rules and you know how to do it." And he says, "Oh, but Radak says." And I said, "I don't care what Radak says. He's an interpreter. He's no different than I am." And he said, well, you should know that Radak says the same thing. I said, okay, exactly. My point is made. If you learn this information, you'll be able to do these things by yourself. Basically what happened was that I had a conversation with Rico Cortez several years ago. So we had a conversation, and we went back and forth for quite a while. We were sitting in his hotel room when he was visiting Israel. And that's when I started thinking. And I actually contacted Nehemiah Golden at one point, and we started talking as well. And that's when I kind of made several decisions. And I said, and if you understand something, I read articles and books and listened to conferences and everything, trying to figure out how on earth do I take the Torah, the verses of the Torah, as the text that we have today. If there's any variations of the text, I'm still looking for them. Serious variations, not small changes. And how do we work from there into the oral law? And I studied books like the Midrashei Halakha, the halachic books that explain how to get from transition from a verse into an actual practice. And I studied the discussions of what came first and everything. I started looking into different groups that existed in the past, and I read about different cults and whatever it was. And I kept on reading books about oral law, and there was this book about Torah from the heavens, and this guy was trying to explain, and he did a really bad job. And I've never found anyone who actually explains the issue of oral law very well. There are elements of our oral law that could be truthful, but the concept itself is very problematic. And basically, since I started talking with Nehemiah Golden, he opened up a lot of things for me as an individual. And we've always had discussions, and he kept on referring to me as his ultra-Orthodox friend, his dati friend. Dati means a religious person. I still walk around with a kippah on my head, and I still wear rabbinic tzitziot and everything, though I don't agree with the way it's supposed to be. The way it's supposed to be tied really sounds more like what the Karaites do. But I don't hold by a lot of rabbinic decrees, but it explains how I know what Karaites say about certain things, and my ability to actually explain verses outside of the rabbinic interpretation. And I don't think my journey is over. Yeah, what are you saying?
Oh, certainly not. The journey is never over, too. I mean, but let me just clarify a couple of things, if I may, Yoel, just for the sake of the listeners, because sometimes, well, let me begin by just asking you this question. Would you now define yourself as a Karaite?
The answer is no, because mm-hmm. if you actually know what Karaites actually say about different things, if you actually sit down and read Karaite books, you kind of realize that they do divert away from the words of the Torah itself. They do have traditions and stuff like that. And
these are traditions that you don't necessarily adhere to.
Yeah, I'll give you one example. They have a discussion about the issue of work during Shabbat, and they have this philosophical concept of the cause and effect. If you start something before Shabbat and it continues into Shabbat, it's considered as if you're doing work at that moment, and you're sleeping, and it's considered as if you're working. And those are ideas I can't really accept. The mm-hmm. synagogue idea, I have trouble with the concept of synagogues in general. I don't think that God wants us to build shrines every corner every corner in every high place like they do in mm-hmm. the Jewish world. Mm-hmm. But I do appreciate the issue of going down on your knees while praying and everything. I usually pray at home, and I read the Torah portion for my family and stuff like that. And you know, it's an issue of, you know, we do need some kind of centralized system. But essentially, the Torah mostly is given to our hands to practice. Now, the issue of interpretation, yes, the answer is that you can't, I mean, based on scripture, I'm basically saying you can't sit there and interpret for yourself as extreme as some people do. But I think that because there is no committee of elders and there's no, you know, there's no king, there's no system, you know, it's really open to interpretation until God will bring a prophet and his anointed one and the high priest and people will start realizing that the Levites have a job and the priests, the Kohanim have a job, you know.
Amen.
And, you know, I do hold that I do have some kind of an authority because I'm a descendant of the house of Levi, but I don't think I'm the final word, and I don't think that, you know, you have to listen to what I say. That's as blunt as I can be. It's yes, sure. As a heritage, it's my responsibility. But as a fact, there are many very intelligent people out there, and I have several of them as people who I know, and they do very well, they interpret very well, and I've learned from them as well. I don't think that the fact that I was born into becoming a Levite makes me a final authority on everything. But I do think that we do have to start striving to reestablish certain things. And I actually was an activist with Temple Mount activity to reestablish an altar and bring back certain things. And that might be part of the effect of understanding the Bible, that God has a plan, and you know, we have to strive to fill in as much as we can of His plan. But Karaites are a development, and they have their little things that they have to fix as well, to be blunt.
So sure. So now with the oral law, I mean, obviously there is what is regarded to be the oral law. What you're saying is that you don't believe it is binding in the same way that the Torah is binding. Is that fair? Am I representing you when I say that?
Well, put it this. Interpretation is interpretation. We have to break down the Torah and the oral law into three categories. There's traditions, which are not necessarily always bad, as long as they don't contradict laws. There's decrees of the elders, which are basically sometimes where a community has certain rules that's reasonable as long as it doesn't break Torah. For example, if there's a community rule that, you know, we don't make noise between 2 and 4 in the afternoon, like we have a law here in Israel like that, that's just communal law. There's nothing wrong with that. But the tree is, if it's divine and if you break it, you should be executed and everything, you know. You know, just leave us alone, you know, just, sure. But we have that. That's one of the problems, that every little stupid thing, any stupid tradition, any little decree that a rabbi sneezes, it becomes holy. That's kind of the thing that drives me mad.
Okay. But at the same time, I'm just clarifying, you would agree. I think you would appreciate this, and I just want to convey this to the listeners. There's an enormous amount of wisdom to be found in the oral law. There's an enormous amount of beauty to be found in the oral law. But what you're against, if I understand you correctly, is that when things are enforced as binding, when things are enforced as divine decrees that clearly contradicts what is written, that is what you have a problem with. Have I represented you there?
That is correct. And then they have the last part, which is basically the issue of interpretation. And if you ever sit down to actually study the rabbinic sources that deal with interpretation, direct interpretation from the verses, first of all, you learn that they didn't have always an oral law. There's some, a lot of stuff that we do today as Orthodox Jews, and a lot of the imitations that I see maybe imitations is a harsh word, but so a lot of the stuff that I see in, for example, the Hebrew Roots movement and Messianics, is a lot of it's not even biblical. It's just, you're just, you know, wearing a kippah, you know, so what, you know, that doesn't make you following Torah. I mean, I bump into these people that put a kippah on their head, though. Now I'm following Torah. No, it doesn't, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. There is an issue of, like, you know, elders and high ranking people who covered their heads, but a layman, you know, just a regular schmo, you don't have to cover your head. No one's going to force you that. But the issue of interpretation, again, there are the more extreme people who go like, oh, how dare they? And now people realize, no, they were trying to interpret the Torah the best they can. I usually take that approach. But I allow myself to disagree with them. And for example, if they sit down, they say that, what is a classic? Oh, here's a complex example. For example, if you have a woman that the husband, the day after the first night of the marriage, claims she wasn't a virgin. He says, "Oh, the parents would bring out the virginity of their daughter, and they would spread the sheet."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, essentially, anyone who's married knows that, you know, there's bleeding when on the first night, and the simplest thing to say is that she has this piece of cloth. And she goes out, and the parents go out, and they show, here's the blood that came from the first consummation of marriage. Here's the proof. But in the Midrash al-Acha, they go into these different things. They have, no, it's like spreading a piece of cloth or a sheet, like something which is clear, like that. Oh, you do some test, and they go into this whole theoretical thing of placing her on a barrel of wine and then smelling if she really was a virgin last night, she wouldn't attract the smell into her body. And it's going like, what? Seriously? It's like, what do you think you're doing? That's stuff that really ticks me off, because basically you're it's very clear and you're jumping into this. What do you think you're doing? You know? So things like that, examples like that, you know, but in some places they get it right. And for example, there's a discussion about how do you build a sukkah, and there are places where you have the book of Nehemiah, and it seems as if they built, and it probably is the truth, they built the sukkah from the tabernacles. They built them from the four plants and three plants and one fruit, which are described in the book of Leviticus. But there is a discussion that maybe that was one interpretation, and then someone else came by and said, oh, we have a different interpretation. But it kind of shows that there was a dynamic of, okay, let's read the text and see what we understand from it.
But well, now this is the question, because, I know that many rabbinic Jews have said to me, well, if we don't have the oral law, how can we continue in the traditions? I mean, how do you know what the written word says if you don't have the oral law to show you how it's practiced? Is that a fair claim?
I don't think that's a fair claim, for one very simple reason. When you don't know anything else, or you don't know another way, then you always stand there and say, I don't know anything else besides this, and therefore I'm going to cling to it to dear life.
Well, let me give you an example, Yoel, because we're on this now. I'm going to give you this example. I had one rabbi say to me, who I love, great guy, said to me, for example, he said, when you read about circumcision, how do we know it's not circumcising the tip of your finger or circumcising your nose or the end of your elbow? And I think, it doesn't specifically say.
No, do me a favor. The point is that when you know a language, you have terminology in it. You have culture in it. You have context. Mm-hmm. The practice of circumcision, first of all, wasn't something unusual in the ancient Near East. A lot of groups circumcised. So the word mila, lamul, the root of mul, always meant circumcision of the foreskin. It's like the discussion about, and the same discussion. How do you know how to slaughter an animal? How do we know? Very simple, because the word shachat and zavach, but mostly shachat means to slaughter by the neck. That kind of type of an argument, like, and by the way, that's a classic argument. That's an argument that's been around since the times of the Mishnah, that we're having discussions like these with people who didn't believe in your rulers. How do you know how to circumcise? Well, the fact remains that many rabbis did not really know Hebrew that well. It wasn't that they didn't know any Hebrew. It's just that their Hebrew wasn't as good as what we have today. They didn't use it as a spoken language.
Mm-hmm. So this particular rabbi, he does know his Hebrew very well, but I was fascinated with the question that he asked me. He said, but how can you derive from the text what this means? For example, like you just mentioned, how to slaughter an animal properly. It was beyond him how that could be derived from the text just by itself. And I had to conclude that was such a foreign concept to him, because that is the way that he was brought up, and that's what he's been brought up. This is the way that he must think. And I could relate to that, and I felt for him, because I remember thinking exactly the same way about certain things in Sunday Christianity, and getting out of that mindset, as you've been, I guess, traveling for the last 15 years, this journey from being strictly in the Orthodox faith and adherence to the oral law, to where you are now.
There's a growing number of Jews who grew up in the Orthodox world that have come to realize that there are questions and there are problems. Mm. And some people just decide to continue on and put the questions in a drawer and get back to them at a later stage. I've been doing that for years. And then I decided, okay, enough is enough. We live our Bible through rabbis who lived in a very, very specific culture. We have access as much as we can into the ancient culture, and we have mm-hmm. more knowledge of what was done, some information, probably a lot of information that rabbis did not have. It doesn't mean they mm-hmm. knew nothing. It doesn't mean they didn't have any cultural references. It doesn't mean that they didn't have a lot of information. There's a lot of stuff that you can find just by reading rabbinic quotes and stuff like that, which gives you information about the ancient world. They did know a lot of things, but in their world, and believe me, in the world I grew up in as well, it was inconceivable and completely impossible.
As the
heavens and the earth stand, literally. As the heavens and the earth stand, and there's a sun in the sky, that it is impossible that there's no oral law. That was the mindset I grew up with as a child. Mm-hmm. It was inconceivable. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing.
Inconceivable.
Sorry, I always confuse those two words. I always say inconceivable, but it's inconceivable. My mother's always correcting me.
It always reminds me of, remember the movie The Princess Bride? And he says to him, you keep on using that word.
Inconceivable!
I do not think it means what you think it means. Anyway, and I agree with what you're saying. And this is the question, and I have one last question. Can I ask you one more question?
Mm-hmm.
Would you now, with the confession you've just made, would you now regard yourself, can you still call yourself an Orthodox Jew?
It's kind of a problem, because when you say Orthodox, you mean one thing, and when you say Karaite, you mean another thing. And I can't call myself Orthodox. At least from now on, I can't really do that anymore, because I've come in the open what I believe in certain things, and I don't really believe in Orthodoxy. But I am still very mainstream. I have not detached myself. I don't go deliberately against practices. You know, you won't see me sitting eating a cheeseburger because I can. No, I don't do that. I do conform to certain things. I don't need to eat a cheeseburger, and I don't need to go and, use electricity in front of everyone during Shabbat or something or anything like that. You know, if I don't have to do it, then it doesn't matter. But when it's something which is important, like when is Yom Kippur, when is Passover, how do you practice this? How do you do that? Those would be places where I will put my foot down, sure.
So you're out of the box now. You're out of the box. You're not in the box anymore.
It was a very small box. I got too big for the box. You know, you kind of realize at one point that people kind of noticed.
So listen. So now you're not. Is it fair to say that you're a contextual Jew? You study what is written. You do what is written. Is that fair? You derive
I would say that I am a follower of the law of the God of Israel. I am a believer in the law of the God of Israel.
Amen.
I don't know if we have to put labels. I am a descendant of the house of Levi, who belongs to the people of Israel, who received the Torah in the Sinai desert through the messenger of God called Moshe, and I'm a student of Moshe ben Amram.
That's way too long for a denomination. But you're out of the box. He's out of the box, so get out of the confession box now, because you're no longer in the box. and Yoel Ben Shlomo, my friend. No, that's a program. We can't do Samuel now.
This raises a question. You know, now that I'm outside of the box, what do I do with the name of God?
Well, what it says. What does it say? You tell me. Are we going to put you on the spot? What? You know what to do with it.
I don't know.
You do know.
I do know, but I don't know. Let me explain. You've no idea. You know, Nehemiah just wrote a book.
Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence, the Hebrew Power of the Priestly Blessing Unleashed, available in Truth to You.
So, first of all, it's a very good book. If you haven't read it yet, do it.
Awesome book. Awesome book.
I actually remember when Nehemiah started the research. It happened to be that we read the same book, and we actually drew some certain lines from the same place. But what do I do with this? Because, you know, in the Jewish world, it's extremely offensive. Mm-hmm. It's extremely offensive to do it. I remember sitting there, and there was this lady, and she was standing there, and she was messianic or something, and she was standing there, and David slew Goliath with the might, and she said, you know, the more, you know, Christian, mm-hmm. the more, the way you usually hear it from people who come from the Christian background, and he says, no, you mustn't say that, you mustn't say that, and he got really upset, and, you know, and it happens a lot. And it's very confusing to people when someone stands there and says this or that.
So, you know, that's a good question, because I have to admit, Yoel, I have to admit that, you know, if I'm in someone's lounge room and it's offensive to them, though I have no problem with something, well, let's talk about the name. I'm not about to use it because I don't want to offend them. And I'm in their lounge room. I'm in their house, right? But if I'm in my own house, I have absolutely no problem using the name. Now, if I have a guest, if I invite someone to my house and I know that they would be offended by me using the name, perhaps there's the – now, would I use it? I don't know. But on the program, as you know, I have no problem using it. You have no problem with me using it. In the past, you haven't used the name. But it's –
Well,
it's,
I did. I've had said Yud Hei Vav Hei. Sure. But that's not what's called Hoge Et Hashem Beotiyotav. I mean, the one who pronounces the name by its letters. That's actually not what's forbidden. You should know that.
You've used the poetic name of Yah as
I've used the poetic name of Yah. I've used Adonai. I've used Elohim. But I've never actually pronounced Yud Hei Vav Hei with vowel points and everything on the program. I don't know. What do people think about this? I'm waiting for your comments.
That's a really good idea. If whatever the listener's opinion is, please write in and see what you think. Because, of course, Yoel, you know you're always welcome to use the name on the program, particularly when we're reading.
And again, you know, so I might just, you know, maybe say Yud Hei Vav Hei every time or something like that, or whatever it might be. I just might say just Lord, because we're talking in English. I mean, unless I'm quoting a verse, I might quote it in Hebrew and use something. I really don't know how to do with this, because essentially I'm not that open about using the name. You know, maybe it's just one of these mechanisms that, you know, I'm used to not using the name. It's a big taboo thing in our world. I mean, you have no idea how taboo it is. You really don't.
Oh, look, I'm sure it is. So, you know, because we've all got our, and for want of a better expression, we all have our sacred cows in the tradition in which we come from. And for you, this is certainly one of them. So we'd be interested to hear from the listeners on that. There is no way we're going to get into Samuel now. That's a whole program.
Of course we can.
No, we've just done an hour. What are you talking about?
This hasn't been an hour.
And we've got, a page, half a chapter to go. In fact, I can even tell you there's 52 verses in the rest of chapter 14, and we were going to kick off from 36. You reckon we can do it? You still want to do it?
Yeah, let's do this thing.
All right,
it'll be a Purim special weekend program. It's a bit longer.
Okay, so now that you're out of the box, let's see how quickly we can deal with this. It says from 36. Now this is, by the way, he just built an altar, right? And he says, he kind of says stuff before he really thinks. He's pretty rash. He's kind of an impulsive sort of a king, I suppose. And he says, let's go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man. And then the people go, hey, you're king, whatever, just tell us, we'll do it. And then the priest says, I got an idea before we do that. Let's draw near to God here.
and it's interesting, because basically, first of all, we have to remember that God did not really answer him then. Mm-hmm. And he's going like, okay, God's not with me. Okay, let's do something by ourselves. We'll just do it ourselves. And the priest going like, the more rational voice goes, my son, you may you should ask God about this. You know, someone's trying to calm him down. We're seeing a development in his character. He's becoming more, how would I say, self-reliant, maybe kind of arrogant. And this arrogance grows and grows with him until it becomes an evil spirit that God sends onto him. And we're seeing, beginning he's very pious, he's very quiet. When he was declared king, he's hiding behind the donkeys where they're parked, all the Volvos and everything. And now suddenly, that's a joke from a rabbi I learned, the Book of Samuel from. And now suddenly he's suddenly very charismatic. He's doing everything himself. And so this priest stands up, the representative of God. And look, he's used the word HaKohen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even say his name. His name is Achituv.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Achituv, right? Where is it? We mentioned him earlier. Achiah, son of Achituv. And he turns around and says, oh, no, we have to first of all ask God and everything. He goes like, okay, let's ask God. And he goes, Yish'al Sha'ul be'Elohim. And he says, "Ha'ered acharef ishtimah." And then he, and Shaul asked in Be'elohim. He doesn't he doesn't say Yud Hey Vav. He says Be'elohim, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But maybe he doesn't use the actual name of God because maybe there's a distance now, or this is now he's functioning as a priest, so it's before the God, or something like that. In any case, and he said, "Yes." He actually asks a yes no question. Remember, we mentioned this about the yes no questions. And it says, mm-hmm. Should I go after the Philistines? And God did not answer him again.
Mm. And this is, incidentally, last week we did talk about Urim and Tumim. Yeah. And so this is what's being used to determine whether or not, but there is no answer. And then so Shaul said, come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and no one see what this sin is. So instantly he's like, okay, so there's some sin. God's not talking to me. There's something, there's a problem here. And then he reinforces the rash oath that he made, the impulsive oath that he made.
He actually goes overboard with this. He's using something that happened. But by the way, the fact that it says that God did not answer him, I know we mentioned this last time, but did not answer means that the answer was confused. If it was rocks, he pulled out twice one thing and then third time was something else, or maybe little pieces that came out and it didn't make any sense. And we're not too sure what the Urim and Tumim were. I mean, if we go on the tradition...
But for example, hypothetically, if they were two... I'm not saying that they were, but if they were two dice, for example, and you roll them, one says yes, one says no, well, that's not an answer. Actually, it goes on to say, and it points out in verse 41, we'll get there in just a second, but he says, as Jehovah lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die. Well, thanks, Dad. But not a man among all the people answered him. And then
he's very emphatic here. He says, first he uses Chai Yud Hei Vav Hei, as Yud Hei Vav Hei lives, which is a well-known oath form, which is the concept, to take an oath in the name of your God. I actually did that once. I didn't say Yud Hei Vav Hei, but I said, I actually said Chai Hashem, because someone was pressing that. I was lying about something, and I turn around and says, as God lives, I am not lying.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy blinked. And he said, you don't have to be that harsh. And I said, listen, you were being very pressing. I just did something the Torah says to do. I said, as God lives, I did not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never take an oath like that unless I was telling the truth. And the guy the guy realized I was telling the truth, and he left me alone. He's never seen someone do that. But again, I didn't say Chai Yud Hei Vav Hei. I just said Chai Hashem or Chai something. And he says Chai Yud Hei Vav Hei Hamoshiach Yisrael, the one who said, it's a very very emphatic clause, like the one who saved Israel, or who saves Israel. And he even says, and even if it's in me or Jonathan, my son, Jonathan. And then he goes like, He says, he doesn't say if it's with me, it's something I did. Says, even if Jonathan, my son, well, thanks, Dad, you're trying to get me executed here. What about you? Maybe you did something. No, I'm perfect. This is kind of like we're seeing this development, but he's using Jonathan maybe as something else. Another possibility here is that he's using Jonathan as God saved us through Jonathan, even if it's Jonathan, who is obviously the servant of God, who was God sent, even if it's with him, we will kill him.
Mm. And so they put Saul and Jonathan on one side, everyone else is on the other side, and then all the people say, do what seems good to you.
They're very passive.
They're very passive.
He's probably very outraged here, maybe kind of like, pulling with muscles and everything, yelling out. And
they don't want to rock the boat, right? They don't want to rock the boat. They're like, okay, whatever you want, like, just
Just leave us alone.
Get over it and we can go and eat. So verse 41, and Saul said to Yehovah, is that Yehovah Adonai? Elohim of Israel.
No, it says Yud-Heh-Vav-Eh Elohei Israel. Yud-Heh-Vav-Eh, God of Israel.
Give a perfect lot. That's what I've got in the English. Is that what you've got?
So it says Havatamim. There's a lot of discussions with this Havatamim. But it's probably, look at translations, please give us a clear answer. Please, like Urim and Tumim. So maybe he's referencing,
Yeah, of course he is. I think so. I think you're absolutely right. Because as opposed to the non-answer, the lack of answer, the confused answer, the yes and the no, give us a perfect answer, either a yes or a no, whatever it be. And so the lot fell, and Shaul and Yonatan were taken.
Yonatan. No, because it says, Vilchet Yonatan veShaul. The Hebrew says Jonathan and Saul, not Saul and Jonathan.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. And but the people escaped. And Saul said, cast lots between my son and Jonathan and me. So Jonathan was taken. And Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. And so Jonathan said, oh, man, look, I only tasted a little honey with the end of my rod that was in my hand, and now I must die. Now, in the English, Yoel, I know there's no, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, punctuation, as far as Hebrew is concerned, in the English, I've got an exclamation mark, as if he said, and now I must die. But I kind of think there should be a question mark at the end of there. I think he should say, you know, I just tasted some honey in the end of my rod that was in my hand, and now I must die?
No, he actually says, Vayomer ta'om ta'amti b'kseh ha'mateh asher b'yadi. I actually, most definitely, I tasted with the rod in the, which is in my hand, at the end of the rod which is in my hand, a little bit of honey. Here I am, I shall die.
Really?
He needs a mut. Here I am, I will die.
He's declaring in favor of his father's oath, saying, this is what must happen to me. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And then Saul says the following, Vayomer Shaul, and we're reading in Hebrew, because you don't get the idea, maybe you can't get it through the English, but it says, Vayomer Shaul, ko ya'aseh Elohim v'cho yosif, ki mot tamut Yonatan. He's using another oath form. Thus, that Elohim will do, and this is what does your English translation say?
In the English, I've got God do so, and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan.
There's no doubt
in either of their mind.
Yeah, he's this is completely off the wall, and but
you know, you and I did Yephthah, right? Yephthah.
Yeah.
In regards to his daughter, and we speculated on that, whether it meant that she would be in some kind of temple service because she bewailed her virginity, or if she was actually going to have her life taken. The Torah is not so specific, but the
verses, that's not Torah, it's prophets.
In the prophets. So, thank you. But the point, of course, is a rash oath, and she understood. Well, you've said this thing, regardless of whether it was wise or not, it has to be done. And of course, Jonathan, you know, he understands as well. But verse 45, Yoel, I mean, this is really interesting to me. There seems to be, I mean, is it fair to say this is sort of a rebellion against, not only against Shaul, but is this kind of a rebellion against Yehovah? Because it's clear to everybody that he's made this oath. Whether it was wise or not is beside the point. He's done it. It has to be honored. And yet the people say, no, we're not taking it this far. And we're going to take Jonathan. We're going to protect him. We're not doing this. What are you talking about? He saved Israel this day. How do you understand this verse?
I don't know if you remember this discussion that we had back with Yiftach, but we mentioned that there is a rabbinic tradition, and this is actually something I can truly appreciate, where they say Yiftach was so arrogant that he could have actually taken care of this oath and actually saved her. If we actually, how would I say this? There's if you go to the end of, I think it's Leviticus, it might be Leviticus or Deuteronomy. Mm-hmm. Let me just go there for a second.
No, I think it's Leviticus. So
it's Leviticus, the end.
You hear the oath in that day, and then you can.
Yeah, but you can't take an oath to kill me. You try to do that, I will kill you. Okay? Let me be very, very blunt. If you take an oath, you're going to kill me, I will make sure you're goulash. but that's but to be serious, I mean, you can't take an oath to kill someone. That's murder, unless it's an enemy of Israel.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but it says here in chapter 27, verse 29, says any cherem. So cherem is an oath to destroy anything that's taken an oath to destroy for God. Asher Yochoram, which will be that will be Yochoram. We're playing on verb form, noun form. Hebrew does that. Min ha'adam, from man, lo yipade mot yumat. You won't be able to salvage him. You won't be able to give money. Pideon is usually through money. To redeem them. You won't be able to redeem them. They will surely be put to death. So, but the question is, what does this mean? Does it mean that when you take an oath, but God doesn't approve of human sacrifice? He talks about this people who pass their children to Molech, for the fire to Molech.
Also, an abomination.
It's an abomination. It says, "Ki kol kol tovat adonai asher kol tovat adonai asher sana asu ki yaviru b'nei motem ba'esh ki yaviru b'nei motem ba'esh." I'm trying to remember the verse exactly. I can't remember it at the moment. But he talks about this as an abomination.
I'll give it to you in English because it says so. It's in Deuteronomy 18. Do not follow the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or anyone. And then it goes on for a whole list of the, because of these abominations, Yehovah your God drives them out from before you, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. There it is. But it's reiterated a number of times. But yeah, no, this is
So there's a question. What do you mean? So it could be that Yiftach was not allowed to redeem his daughter, and this was actually fine. And it could be that what happens here with Jonathan is a mistake. It's not supposed to be done like this. Or that the context is through war. If you take an oath to fight against the enemies of God, then you have to fulfill this oath. This is something we have to sit down and think about. What do you mean? So you take an oath to kill someone and then run off and kill them? This doesn't make sense. Since when do you find that God wants blood from human beings? I mean, seriously, I'm asking a very serious question here.
Well, you don't find that. You don't find it in the Tanakh, but it's an interesting. I've never followed it through as far as Leviticus 27 is concerned. I haven't considered it in that light. The other thing, Yoel, of course, is that Jonathan didn't hear the oath that his father had made. He was absent. Is it still applicable? I don't know. I mean, this is not something that he has done, as we read about in. Numbers 15, I think it is, where, you know, it's not as if it's a presumptuous sin or something like that. This is something that he's done accidentally. He didn't know.
But by the way, I will say one thing about this verse in Leviticus is there is an interpretation that says that it might be referring to a person who is supposed to be executed. The problem is the context doesn't allow this. The context is about taking oaths of dedicating something to God and stuff like that. But on the other hand, someone who's found guilty and has to be executed, is your duty to kill this person.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of like a flip-flop here, because these are two contradicting stories as well. You have one place where it works very well with the verse here in Leviticus, and there's another place where it kind of presumably contradicts. So how come they save him? And but on the other hand, maybe the loophole is that he did not hear the oath. So he was not obliged to the oath. And whatever his father is saying now is an illegitimate oath, because you can't take an oath on something which is theoretical. And this oath taking is kind of tricky to do, or vows and oaths and stuff like that. But for example, you can't vow me, or you can't vow that I will do something. I can go the heck with it. I'm not interested in doing what you want me to do. And you can stand there and swear in the name of God as much as you like, and I can go, I can just react as like whatever and walk away. And that's part of the problem here. That the loophole here is that there's a problem executing someone for no real reason, specifically if this person actually was not there when the oath was taken, which means he stood there in front of people and he made them take an oath. Jonathan wasn't there. So he actually did not take the oath. And that might be the loophole, which means it might be that Yiftach actually did the correct thing. And here there's a loophole. He wasn't there. He did not take an oath. Therefore, you know, leave me alone. Sure. And Jonathan is just being, you know, very respective of his father. So, you know, here I am, kill me, you know whatever. You're the king.
The other thing, of course, he wasn't there when his father made the oath. Of course, the oath that his father made was, no one will eat anything until I am victorious over my enemies. But Jonathan is the reason why. I mean, Yehovah used him to begin the defeat of the Philistines. And so, I don't know. So it's a complicated one, isn't it?
It's a complicated one. It's a complicated one. And this is, I will say this, that there must be a lot of people out there listening to this now, and they're, You know, I just said something like God does not request any blood from human beings and stuff like that. And everyone's going to jump up and say the obvious thing. And I just want to clarify, I wasn't alluding to anything. I'm just saying, based on scripture, on these verses and everything, and dealing with Leviticus, there is a question. There's a question raised here because we find a problem with human sacrifice. And then on the other hand, we find this verse in Leviticus that says any human being that there's that's been called on that to be killed with basically an oath in the name of God. There's a flip-flop here that you have to play around with.
And just to remind everyone, in case they're not, those who listen to Light of the Prophets understand that we deal with the text from the Tanakh, from cover to cover, within the Tanakh. Okay, we don't need to apologize for stuff that is outside of the Tanakh.
I'm just being friendly. That's all. I'm just being friendly.
Okay. Now listen, they took him. They rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines, you know, they went to their own place. And I reckon we can hammer on to verse 52. What do you think?
Let's do it. No, I would say this is a holiday special. This is a Purim special. We're doing something longer.
There's not much in this anyhow. So Shaul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom,
You're skipping something. You missed out something very important here. It says here, so they actually redeemed him and everything. It says, Vayifdu ha'am et Yonatan velo met. It's interesting, it uses the word yifdu from the root of pada, which is the exact same root used in Leviticus.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Now, Zobah, is that the first time we've read about Zobah?
Zobah, yeah, Malchet Zobah, Aram Zobah, that's Aleppo, basically.
Really?
Yeah, he ventured into Syria.
How about, I didn't know that. Zobah, against the Philistines, and wherever he turned, I've got, he harassed them. Is that what you've got?
When they say that he harassed them, he wasn't going to actual wars. He wasn't doing what David was doing. He went into these... guerrilla attacks. He would go with a small army or a slightly larger army and attack an area. But he wasn't going out to full-fledged war with battlefields against anyone yet. Mm-hmm. The next chapter, we start dealing with actual wars against entire groups. Here, he just went around and was kind of like they're punishing and torturing and going in and causing difficulty. But he wasn't going full head against kings and actual nations and everything, actual armies.
So we actually see here, because this reminds me of, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think at the beginning of Judges, it talks about how those who were left in the land that should have been kicked out were there, that they were harassing Israel and they became a thorn in their sides.
Yeah.
Here we see Shaul and Israel is beginning to be a thorn in their sides. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hand of those who plundered them. Nice. Now
so,
I'm going to get
so
you.
By the way, first of all, it mentions Amalek here as a statement leading into the next chapter where he actually talks about what he did with the Amalekites. This is what the text sometimes does. We've seen this a couple of times. We introduced Achiav, the son of Achituv, introduced him as the priest, and then we actually spoke about him. So still using the same mechanism here. We're introducing something we're not talking about yet. Hold your horses, we'll get to it. But it's a summary of what he's actually done up to now. Now, by the way, It says, Vayetzeret Yisrael miyad shosehu. Shosehu is from the shasa, which is attackers or tormentors or something like that. But you should know that there is a concept called the shasu, or the sashu, which were... some people claim these were an actual nation. Some people say this was just a generic name for bandits that basically... went from place to place. So it could be that the word shosim or shosehu, their shosim, the shosim of Israel, was a borrowed name from an actual nation called the Shasu, which were bandits. And it just became a general name for certain groups.
Okay.
But here it's probably used, as I said, it's probably used for a general name a generic name for anyone who was tormenting Israel, attacking Israel. You might have had like, you know, small groups of Moabites or Ammonites that go into Israel lands, like we have with the Palestinians today. You don't have organized groups. Sometimes it's just some individuals from some village. They're affiliated with Hamas or Fatah or whatever, or Islamic Jihad or something, and they go out and they do something really by themselves. They're not really planned with anyone. It's not pre-planned. They just go and do something. And he might be dealing with this. These were members of a larger group, and this went in and caused some trouble versus actually attacking or fighting an actual army sent by a specific warlord or a king.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want you to read from 49 to 51. There's a whole lot of Hebrew names in here, and one in particular that I'm curious about.
Okay, so it says, Vayu b'nei Shaul, and the sons of Shaul were Yonatan v'yishvi u'malkishu.
Who's he? Second one after Jonathan.
Okay, so Yishvi, the problem is in the Book of Chronicles, Second Book of Chronicles, there's a guy called Avinadav. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're actually missing a son here based on Chronicles. And Yishvi might have been Ashbaal, okay? And and some people say that Eshbaal was some kind of the word Eshayahu, Eshbaal, and then Baal is replaced by Yahu, so it's Eshyahu, very similar to Yishayahu, Josiah, and that he's called Yishvi here, with a dropping where the Aleph is assimilated to Yi. There's an assimilation of A sound into a Y sound, and the Hey at the end is also assimilated into the V, so it's not Yishayahu, it's Yishvi. Like, for example, my name, Yoel. And if I remember, Hebrew is phonetic, so it might have been vocalized as Yoel or Yovel or something like that at one point, and it's actually vocalized as Yoel, and Yoel is an abbreviation of Yehoel, okay? Like Yehoshua, and the hey was dropped, so we have the same thing here. Yishvi might have been Ishayahu or Ishyahu, fire of Yahu, or Ish, it could be, we read it as Eshbaal, but it might have been Ishbaal, man of Baal, and then it may have been Ishyahu, which is man of Yahu or man of Yah, basically.
Okay. So is it so? Let me just get this straight in my head. Is it possible that it is another name for Avinadab?
There is an opinion that says that it's another name for Avinadav, but there's no etymology between Yishvi or Ishayahu and Avinadav, because Avinadav means my father is generous.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. All right. So who's this next guy? This is Malchishahu?
Malchishua. Malchishua. King saves. My king saves. Shua is from the root of Shua, which is Shava, which is to save.
Mm.
It can be also Yesha. I mean, Shua, let me think about this for a second. Shua, what Shua does appear, Malchishua, it might be that the first Yud was assimilating to the last Yud.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of how they write. Sometimes when there was a scribal tradition to write, if there's a consonant that's the same in between two parts, say for example, if there's a sequence of words and there's two words where the last word of the first word, the last consonant of the first word is similar to the first word of the second consonant, then they only write one of them. It was shorthand writing. So Malchishua might have been Malki Yeshua, my king saves. But Malchishua is an abbreviation where we drop one of the Yudim.
So it suggests to me, Yoel, and tell me if you think this is fair, that he would have had this young lad after he was anointed to be king, to name him my king saves. Is that fair? Or would it have just been a popular name?
It's a possibility. It's a possibility. But on the other hand, Malchishua dies on the battlefield.
Hmm.
And he couldn't. He could, if based on some calculations we did last time or some previous times before, we said he was, you know, maybe reigned for 10 years. So what, he was nine? Mm-hmm. He went to battlefield when he was 9 years old.
That's kind of young. No, that's a good point. It's a good point, Yoel. Doesn't sound right. I agree with you. And the names of his two daughters were, and now I've got Merav.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got that right. And now Michael, is that how you pronounce it? Michael?
Michal.
Michal. Now, there is the English name of Michael, right? Is that how do you it, like as in the book of
Michael? So it might be Michael. It might be that Michal is a feminine form of Michael. It's a possibility, probably a good possibility. It's just, I mean, I haven't studied this name, but I'm saying that it might be the feminine variation of it.
Okay, so that's who they are. The name of Saul's wife. Here's his wife. Ahinoam.
Ahinoam. Yes.
Achinoam. There she is.
Bat Achim.
Is that a, now, listen, is that a popular name still in, are any of these names still popular in Israel today?
So Yonatan, yes. So Shaul is common. Yonatan is common. Yishvi or Yishbaal is not common. Ishayahu, I've met very few people called Ishayahu. Malkishua, I've never met anyone called Malkishua. Mirav and Michal are common.
Achinoam
is common. Achimaatz is not. Achimaatz is not. Interesting.
That's her father's name, right? What does that mean?
Is it her father's name or her mother's name?
I don't know.
Because the word Achi shows up again in the parent name, and she's called Achinoam.
Yeah, true.
Now, it could be, first of all, it's interesting. So it means that the family used certain formulas of names, which is interesting. So Achimaatz might be her father, might be her mother. Achimaatz, as far as I know, is usually a masculine name, so it's probably her father. Mm-hmm. Then you have, in his military, the head of his military is Avinel.
We hear a lot about him later on. He becomes a main character.
Yeah, so Avner or Avner is a name that does exist, common. Mm-hmm. Son of Ner, Ner does not exist. Ner, well, put it this. The word Ner, the Aramaic equivalent of the name Ner is Shraga. And Shraga is a common name, or does exist. And Shraga is the Aramaic word for Ner, which means candle. So Ner doesn't appear, but Shraga does. So there is kind of a continuation of this name. The uncle Shaul, Kish, doesn't exist. Kish, the father of Shaul, and Ner, the father of Avner, the son of Aviel. Aviel, I've never seen someone called Aviel. I don't think there's a family name as Aviel in Israel today.
Aviel. What's that? My father is God?
Avi is El. My father is El.
Okay. There it is. Aviel. Now, there was fierce war, Yoel, with the Philistines all the days of Shaul. And when Shaul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him for himself. And that's actually, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that one of the warnings that that Samuel warned the people with, that, you know, if you want a king, this is one of the things that's going to happen. And here we see that that is fulfilled in verse 52.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's basically what he warned them. And it's interesting, now we're alluding to the next tale as well, is the Philistines. Interesting, it says, and the war was fierce in between on the Philistines. We're alluding to another story later on along the
line.
The stories of Saul and then David.
Yes, we are. And this is a pivotal chapter, which we're going to do next time, but I don't know if we're going to be able to release it next week. I'm going to be so busy. Why am I going to be so busy next week, Yoel?
Because you're just a lazy bum.
Yeah, but besides that,
We're going to be meeting next week. I am actually going to finally meet Mr. John O'Vandor from Australia.
I'm going to finally, now listen,
and
while your signal is coming back, I'm just going to let everybody know that I am I'm going over to Israel. Thanks to the listeners. Thank you so much for those who enabled me to go. We're going to go over to Israel. Myself, meet up with Yoel. We're going to meet up with Keith. Going to meet up with Jeremy. G'day, Jeremy. And we're going to do a whole lot of people on the bus go and spy out the land. I don't even know what the itinerary is, because it's a secret. Because Keith has been keeping it a secret because, you know, we're spying out the land and we can't
get
information. Yoel,
that's his excuse.
That's an excuse. That's what we're doing.
That's the excuse. I mean,
it's secret stuff.
No, but if it says something, you're coming to my land, which means I have to continue my own schedule. Keith, what is going on with you?
You're there. You give it all away.
I don't know anything. I'm seriously, I've been asking him, like, what am I going to be doing? I've been bugging him for months now.
All right, so listen, I'm going to be over there, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be next week, then I'm going to get there later next week, and we're going to keep the listeners up to date as best we can by putting together programs about where we go, what we do, the history, and the experience, and as best we can to bring the listeners along with us. So I'm looking forward to catching up with you, not this Shabbat, but next Shabbat, right? Anyway, my friend, that's what's happening next week, but we will do chapter 15 as soon as we can and get that on to Light of the Prophets, which you've been listening to on Truth to You, truth2u.org. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page that Yoel posts on, Hebrew in Israel on Facebook. And also, if you would like quality Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the land, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on the Truth to You. I look forward to seeing you in person for the first time really, really soon. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kol Tov.